This is Shaping Places from The Conduit and The Crown Estate, and this is our final episode of the series, where we've met the people helping to shape the world around us and asked them to reflect on the places that have shaped them. We've spoken to community leaders, entrepreneurs, activists and policymakers, people improving everyday life in their communities and beyond, and explored the experiences that drive their mission. I'm your host, Dave Erasmus, speaker, coach and thinker, joined once again by my co-host, Matt Mason, Head of Innovation and Skills at The Crown Estate. If you've enjoyed the series, follow Shaping Places wherever you get your podcasts and consider leaving a quick review. It helps others find the show. Our guest today is Daize Agaji, an environmentalist, strategist and creative whose work explores the deep connections between climate justice, identity and culture. Still in her mid-20s, Daize has already achieved remarkable things. She was a founding member of Extinction Rebellion Youth, played a key role in the 2019 London occupation that led to the UK declaring a climate emergency, and went on to help shape the UK's net zero strategy through landmark legal activism. As creative director of Earthrise Studio, Daize has helped grow the platform to millions of followers, inspiring a new generation of climate-conscious citizens. From a Tottenham Council flat to international stages, Daize's story is one of resilience, creativity and determination. Today we'll hear how her upbringing and her activism intertwine, why youth voices matter in the climate movement, and what it takes to turn personal struggle into global impact. Daize, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm excited for today. Matt Mason, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Dave.
So last time I saw you, we were very off-grid. We were up north somewhere at a retreat kind of environment with wild swimming and in a wood-fired hot tub. And I think the nature of the conversation is probably similar, different or complementary to what we talk about today.
I think it will be very complementary, to be honest. But yeah, it's a very different environment.
Well, different places shape conversations in different ways, don't they? But today we find ourselves in the Conduit Studio, place that you're familiar with, isn't it? The Conduit.
Yes, I'm one of their impact champions here.
So you do so many different things that touch so many different worlds, the intersections of activism and solutionism and everything in between. But before we get into what you're up to now, why don't you take us right back to the beginning? Where does it all start for Daize?
Well, I think in order to like really talk about where it all starts, I actually have to go to my mum. So my family is originally from the Niger Delta, which is in the southern area of Nigeria, or modern day Nigeria. And yeah, my mum belonged to a very small village just off the Delta. When she was about 10 or thereabouts, her father died. And then my mum actually became one of the breadwinners for her large family. My mum has many different siblings, about 9. And my mum and her sister came to the UK and came to London. And I guess I say that because there is something about my mum's story that really bridges the gap to understand, like, the situation that I was born into. My mum, she had kind of like gone through the very traditional migrant story and then ended up in Tottenham by the time I was born, already with my older brother. And I grew up in a house that was really poor. We lived in a one-bedroom flat in Tottenham, just off the Tottenham Hotspur football area. That was like the beginning of me and my story. It was growing up in this really economically challenging times in, you know, the year 2000 and onwards.
What was going on in Tottenham at that time?
Tottenham was really difficult, I guess. And, you know, I feel like I still sometimes have those negative connotations of Tottenham when I was younger, where everyone thought, God, you don't want to go to Tottenham when it's too dark. And that was like the place. But then also, like, as myself at the time, I didn't know that I lived in poverty. I thought everyone experienced the life in the way that we did. But now looking back, I can see that there was such strong community connection because of this shared struggle. Before Tottenham Hotspur became this massive mega stadium, there used to be a community centre right at the back of it. Actually, it still might exist today. I'm not too sure. But yeah, it was the place that we would spend our weekends of where we would go on like LimeWire and like try to download like, you know what I mean? Like the newest Drake song and then share it over Bluetooth with each other. And it's like all of those kind of like memories of this place that was almost like categorized through the shared struggle. Mm. But in that, like birthed a really strong sense of community and belonging.
Mm. And then take us through Tottenham. Where do we go from there in your journey?
So this is where I say my mum's story is like such a large part of my own story. My mum, she is the most determined woman in the world. And she had a dream that she was going to own a restaurant, like a literal dream in the night. And she saw this shop in her dream. It was a travel agent. And there was a wire hanging from the ceiling. And my mum is so determined that even though we lived in overt poverty, she was having all these relational issues, etc. She was like, oh, okay, I've had this dream and this dream is going to happen. So bearing in mind, she didn't even have a bank account at this point. She decided to start looking for that location of this restaurant that she'd seen in her dream. And a couple of months later, she ended up finding it on the high street of Edmonton. And you know, those moments of like fluke of chance of where the lady who had owned the kind of lease of the restaurant, her partner had just recently passed away and he was the one who used to run the travel agency. So she just wanted to get rid of it. So she basically told my mum, like, why don't you just take this? And then if you can pay me back within the year, that would be really nice. But if not, like, I'll just take the thing back and then I'll try and sell it to someone else. So my mum ended up getting this premises that she hadn't really planned for, that she had no money to actually turn it from a travel agency to a restaurant. And then she ended up having these conversations. And like, I grew up in the church in the UK, like the Pentecostal church. Mm. And she mentioned it to a pastor. And then he was like, oh, okay, well, we should probably talk to the church about this. And through that community, my mum ended up raising enough money in order to populate the restaurant and like convert it from a travel agency to a restaurant. And then her dream became reality of where she suddenly became an owner of a restaurant.
I think this is an amazing example of how people literally draw stuff down from the heavens.
I also was just kind of internally reflecting on the amount of courage it takes to jump in with 2 feet into something like that.
But definitely.
For somebody who is coming from the circumstances that you've already described, you could understand being more risk averse than your average person in those circumstances. Mm. And yet to have the courage to grab onto this opportunity is amazing.
Yeah, I definitely do think seeing her self-actualize her dreams at such a young age for me made me feel like anything I wanted with enough hard work can become a possibility. Mm. And it made me a dreamer through watching her do it. And I guess, you know, coming from an impoverished background and my mum losing someone who she loved so dearly so early on, I think that kind of sticks with her. Mm-hmm. Like, is it truly courageous if you know that you kind of like have to surrender to life a little? Mm. And she learned that at such a young age, you know, that sometimes things just happen to you and you have to like figure out how to respond to that. Mm. And I think there's something about that that I find quite interesting in the conversation of courage.
So that would have made a change for you then.
Massively.
She's got this travel agent come restaurant.
Yeah, my mum's restaurant was really successful. It's still actually running today. I actually had a takeaway this lunch from it.
Great.
But from that time, like our family dynamic like totally changed because we ended up living this one bedroom house in Tottenham with, you know, me and my brothers ended up sleeping on the same bed and my mum would sleep on the couch and my dad would sleep on the floor. Like that was our setup for most of our life. And then with the restaurant, my mum was able to find independence on her own. So my father ended up leaving. But then also she bought her house and it's like our whole life's like quite literally changed in the space of a year of where we went from being extremely impoverished to being kind of middle class. Mm. You know, we moved just out of Tottenham into Enfield, but like still walking distance. Because my mum's always managed to like balance this loveliness of like giving us opportunity, but then also never allowing us to forget. My mum also started to realise that whilst running this restaurant and also having 3 kids at this time, because my brother was born like 2 years after me, she was unable to like give us the attention that we would need to kind of have an upbringing in London. Because of, you know, all the challenges it is to be a teenager in London and in an urban area. So she ended up talking to one of my aunties who had a child in boarding school about us going to boarding school. My older brother went and he loved it. He became a different person through that experience. My mum asked me if I wanted to go and I said yes.
Before we move off Tottenham, I was keen to go back to food. And so your mum's focus for like moving up was restaurant. And presumably that came from a passion for food and cooking. Was food a big part of your life at home?
Yeah, it was such a big part. Food was like the one way that she could keep us connected back to like our motherland.
What was the smell in the, and was it Nigerian food in the restaurant?
Yeah.
And so what was the smell of the best food that it was in at home or the restaurant?
Oh, I think the smell is like very heavily spiced, you know, in the air. And also there's like a lot of like tomato-y kind of like rich, like it's really rich, like, you know, like cuisine. It's like,
I'm glad I've had lunch. Otherwise I would be in trouble right now.
I'm just trying to work out how far Edmonton is from.
Yeah, exactly. Swing past on the way back.
Skegness doesn't strike me as a hotbed of Nigerian cooking. So
was
that one of the culture shocks was, you know, being ripped out of this home where you had amazing Nigerian food cooked for you to a state boarding school in Skegness, I'm assuming isn't serving jollof rice. And
I remember like the first day of school, I remember my mum dropping me off. And like at this point, like I was actually quite excited at this like new opportunity to do something like slightly strange. I remember telling all my friends, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to boarding school. How weird. And I remember like the first morning being woken up by my house parents, looking outside and just seeing like a bunch of like fields and cows. And that moment, it was the moment that I was like, oh God, what have I done?
Yeah. Does it just look too sparse? Does it look alien? What was the feeling?
I think it was just really alien. Like I'd lived my whole life in like a very urban part of the city. And it didn't particularly help that the majority of people of colour in the local vicinity, not just the school, were boarders.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were three families that I knew of in the local vicinity who were black or brown.
Mm.
And I remember like feeling a bit weird about it all at the beginning. And I guess this kind of takes me into like how nature became a really big part of my life, as I ended up actually feeling like I needed to retreat into myself. And in that, I ended up spending a lot of time outside almost to escape. And that's when I first fell in love with nature.
You went to boarding school and had this kind of awakening to nature.
Yeah.
That isn't the end of the story. What happened?
Yeah.
Like, where did you go from there?
So after boarding school, I just felt like I needed to go and experience something different. So I ended up actually deciding, instead of going to like another boarding school or a private school, whatever, like I actually just wanted to go to state school and like, you know, come back to London, live with my mum, having really got accustomed to being in this quite like, you know, especially like the time I was leaving Skegness around that kind of like 2016, 2017 time. I remember the Brexit elections being a really large part of that. And this also was another reason I felt like I needed to leave, was because the appetite to accept difference was lowering. And I could definitely feel that. And yeah, and in this time, I also started getting some like really bad health issues because I was living back in Edmonton. And yeah, I was like having a lot of issues around like my breathing and my skin, and everything was just like going wrong in my body. And the doctors didn't really have an idea for me. They put down the breathing to everyone in London has asthma. So what am I meant to do about this? Here's an asthma pump. And I was just like, yeah, I was really curious to be like, I haven't had these issues before. And then they've just like come out of nowhere. So I started looking online, and then I stumbled across like this thing about air pollution. And I'd found out about like this incinerator that was like a couple miles away from my house, and the fact that there are incinerators in inner city areas, which kind of feels like strange because you're like, why
dystopian.
Would you? Yeah, like it was like, it just felt like, oh, like what? Yeah. And then I started reading into about the implications of like incinerators on people's health. You start to look at the stuff as like, oh yeah, like incinerators are like traditionally put in working class areas, are traditionally put in areas that are heavily populated by black and brown people. And you're like, oh. And then you stumbled sadly across some news articles talking about the climate crisis. And bearing in mind, like I was like at this time, like 16, 17, I'd never really heard about the climate crisis before. Well, not in like a vivid enough way for me to remember.
Yeah.
And then it just became really real. I felt this relationship of where like, I couldn't see the difference or the split between myself and nature. Mm. You know, like your best pal, like when you're a teenager or something, you just don't see the split between you. Mm. And then hearing about how this environmental and climate crisis would affect the way she would be forever, like literally sent me into like the pits of despair. And I ended up getting really badly depressed about this and like developing anxiety and like all these things. And like I would try to talk to my mum about it, but she just wouldn't get it. And yeah, it's just really disheartening. And yeah, like I had challenges with my feelings about all of this stuff, not just because my body was actually just like depleting itself with like the development of like these chronic illness issues, but then also there was this like deep grief. And at the time I would not have described it as grief. I just thought I was depressed.
It struck me when you were talking about how your experience of coming back to your mum and your mum not getting it, it shows how important your experience was in Skegness, I guess, like that connection that you built by being so close to nature and in nature is what allowed you to get it in a way that maybe the rest of your community back in Tottenham couldn't, because they hadn't had that experience and they hadn't formed that connection that, that you had.
And also there's like, you know, another thing of where like, especially from like a perspective like migrants or like people with migrant history, which a lot of people beyond black and brown people have in this country, it's like a lot of people's ancestral trauma of being disconnected and displaced is so real.
You're back. We're in London. There's so much in your current like CV, let's say, of stuff that you're up to. But I just feel like the real heart of it that I want to get to is, what kind of things are you seeing or doing or imagining that really get at how to bring that regenerative, additive, generous, transformative spirit back into the city? Because it's such a contested space.
At the moment, I think, like, I don't know, I've spent the last couple of years throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. So like to run through, you know, after like going to university, I ended up stumbling into this group that later, well, not later became, at the time it was Extinction Rebellion, but it was tiny. And Roger Hallam, who's like one of the co-founders of this movement, went on almost like the clergyman. It was like, Jesus is coming. But he had a moment where he was like, we will stop Pret from getting its sandwiches because we are going to have a rebellion on the streets of London. And I remember thinking, oh God. But then also it was the first place that it felt like this deeper hurt and wound about the climate crisis feeling addressed, and the first place that I felt that I was sane for caring and that my deep care was actually a useful tool in understanding how to change things. And meeting other people of where that care was not something that was kind of like weird or moist, but it was human. It was deeply human. And where that care was not just extended to the natural world, but extended to each other with such generosity. One of my first meetings there, I was like in the deep depth of my depression at this time. And my new friend at university, she had invited me along. So I ended up going, and the fundamental part of this meeting that I feel like changed like the chemistry of my brain was at the beginning of these meetings, we would do these things called check-ins of where, you know, we'll go, oh, good, how are we? And like we did one round and then it got to me, they were like, how are you doing today? I was like, fine, you know, and then the second round, they were like, how are you doing? And everyone started opening up a little bit more. And bear in mind, like, this is a room of people who have been, I've sat here for like maybe like 5 minutes with. I didn't actually want to go in. There was this woman called Amy who ended up fetching us from outside because she could see our indecision at the door. It was the first time that like I was met and held in my grief about the natural world and the world that we were finding ourselves in. And I think this is the thing, like we watched the destruction of the natural world, but when I see the climate crisis, this is the edge that we're going towards is the climate. But the things that we do to each other as humans are the things that happened before. But in order to address the climate crisis, we have to address the rest, you know? And it was like this moment of where like all of the things I'd been thinking about, whether it was like the racism that I'd experienced and all of these things and seeing it as like part of this larger issue. Yeah, it was the first time that it was like really open. I was like, oh, okay, yeah. Like I'm really scared about the future that we're inhabiting. I don't feel like I can live the life that I told myself I would live. And it was the first time we'd cried in like years. But in that, like, that was like the birth of this, like, reckoning with myself about who I decide to be in these times, of where we're called to be something so much bigger than I think we are told by the narrative of the world that we live within. So it was kind of like this journey into activism. I ended up being a part of this revolution, this 2019, the big boat. I remember my mum at this point still didn't get what was going on. because yeah, it was probably the craziest things that I had done in my life was join a movement of where I basically wished my employability goodbye before I even left university. And yeah, and it was really beautiful and it was awe-inspiring. And one of the like real memories I have, especially around Nature Connection and these like moments of healing in my life, was on Waterloo Bridge during the 2019 rebellion. It was lined with trees. And it was the living bridge. And it was showing us a world that we could inhabit if we chose to. And this like aim of possibility and the decision that we can just do. And then that started the beginning of everything, of where after a couple of months, I ended up being asked to run for election. And I was like, yeah, let's do this. I ended up running for election in the last European parliamentary elections, which were like a funny election because even if you won, you would only have 3 months because we'd already Brexited out. But then it became almost like a mockumentary run because like I just did this thing where I was like, actually, we need to talk about climate. And that was my one thing. It was like climate and democracy and a better way to be. And yeah, it just led into this like kind of like trajectory into a world that was very much based on activism and doing these things in collaboration with people to get people to recognize where we need to be.
I think there's also a lesson in there in that the thing that moves people is generally the emotional connection. But a mechanism for delivering nature are often frameworks and policies. And I think that there is huge value in some of the targets that, you know, are being set around everybody should be within X minutes of green space and should be able to see however many trees out of their window. And but you can't really like count a connection to nature like that.
And I think that links back to what you talked about when you came back to London, you had lost your way to be with her, I think you said.
Yeah.
And forgive me if I've paraphrased it wrongly, but I think, yes, you need frameworks and rules and minimums of lots of nature values, but also encouraging people to find their own practice to interrelate with nature, even if it's absolutely tiny, the real estate on which it exists. But it's that, how do we encourage that practice?
Yeah, I think there's something about, you know, you kind of touched upon it at some point, because I do think stories are such a large part of the way that we relate to things. And, you know, a lot of my work now is in the culture space. It's kind of like between politics, culture, and environment. Because the stories that we tell ourselves are deeply important, because at one point, our culture used to tell us stories about our shared values. Whether it's folk songs, protest songs, like all of these things would tell us about ourselves. You know, there's so many different songs that I love, but one that talks about justice, because it would tell us that we need justice, but it would also tell us that we need the softness to have space to cry, you know, and it's an allowing of this thing that allows us to build a culture, a larger culture that's able to hold this. So I think there's something about that. And at the moment we're like watching this like folk revival. There are so many interesting people who are taking the heritage customs of the UK, but playing around with them to adapt them to new folk who are here, you know, and folk customs are really interesting because I find them interesting because they are one but different. So all across the world, there are so many folk customs, whether it's the stories that we tell ourselves, the dancing, the costumes, etc. And they're all kind of always connected to nature because that's the one thing we've always had through humanity's existence. But you can see the parallels in them. Like there's masquerade culture in the Niger Delta, where my family's from, that looks eerily similar to the Winstable Blair. And even though they're on other sides of the world, they can still share the same stories, the same like rhythm, because that's like our shared humanity in play. But they can also have the difference of showing up slightly differently, you know. And I think there's something about that that I find really interesting in us re-indigenizing ourselves, to go back to one, like, you know, I think migrants should be involved in learning about the folk customs of this land, but also bringing their own so we can see the similarity and see that we're actually all interconnected and we're all kin, and we all kind of go towards this same culture, this value of togetherness, of commonality.
I want to get practical at the end of this. You've done so many things and you've got such a rich story. Thank you so much for letting us look into lots of different corners together. It's been a real joy. But if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, what should I do? What would you encourage them if it was their first moment of what on earth's going on out there with the climate, with nature? Where do you point them, especially if they're an inner city person and this is all new to them? What's one or two things that they should head towards, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think it's so deeply personal. I think that's one. I think there is like a go of your gut with this. But I think like one, finding time to be in nature, especially in our like ever busy lifestyles. Find time to like be in nature. And even if it is just like taking off your shoes and sitting in that park with your friends, I think does a lot for people that I don't think people are like fully aware of. I think there's one part of that. I also think connecting back to culture, whether cultures of this land or lands that you previously came from, is really important. I do feel like my steadfastness in life is because I really know where I'm from. I'm just so lucky to have this dual heritage of knowing my Nigerian family and the folk laws of that land, but also knowing this too and seeing that similarity and recognizing that that's a part of our like shared story. And the last thing is this, like, we've stumbled around agency as like, you know, a large part of that, but we are, we are living in a time of where the story that we're told is that we don't have agency. And I think that is on purpose, so we don't actually decide to ask for what we want and what we need. So yeah, it's a reminder to practice your agency. And one of the things that I love to say, but I think most practical people really hate when I say this, but whenever I'm asked, what can I do for the climate? What can I do for, you know, democracy, etc., I always say that we should learn how to act in love, duty, and care for every action we take. Because if you could fundamentally ground your values in something like love, duty, care, empathy, like, it will change every action you decide to take, because you'll think about it differently. You know, like the idea of like going into like a field and like leaving my rubbish is like so something that like literally cognitively can't exist in my mind, because I use love and care and action for everything and everyone as a part of the way that I live my life.
I think one of the things that has kind of jumped out to me across all of the conversations we've had is that I think it's particularly relevant in this conversation about taking action to tackle climate, is it can be very easy to feel like you are and you expressed this earlier, Days, you're the only one that cares about this, or I care about this more than other people. Mm. And we've spoken to a number of people who have taken that step to like put themselves out there a little bit and say, hey, I'm passionate about this thing and I'm thinking of doing something. Is that interesting to anyone else? And been kind of overwhelmed by the response.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God, I'm also really passionate about that and totally want to be involved in this. And all of a sudden they've gone from thinking, you know, I'm kind of on my own to, oh my God, I've got to organize this like community of people.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing I would add to your list of like what people can do is also be open about your passion about, if you're passionate about the environment and about the things that we could be doing in order to tackle climate change, talk about it, bring people with you, because I think you'll find that there are more people than you realize who are thinking the same thing and probably trying to navigate the same questions of, I feel like it's just me, what can I do on my own? But actually, if you start to find other people who are in the same position, it becomes, well, what can we do?
I agree.
And that is where technology can be super helpful as well, whether it's a Facebook group or whatever it might be, to share that idea so that it doesn't get squashed just in your dorm room or on your street. Because sometimes you have to look a little bit around to find those first one or two people to join you.
Yeah.
But it goes back to that intuition point you made earlier, Days, about, I think what you're saying is to encourage people that if you're feeling it, somebody else is probably feeling it too.
Yeah.
So start off in Extinction Rebellion and doing that kind of cultural work there and the environmental work there. But then also recognizing that like it wasn't working in the same way that it used to at one point. And then went off to go and do Earthrise, different campaigning, all of that, kind of coming back with the same group of troublemakers from Extinction Rebellion. Mm-hmm. Most of us were working in strategy, media, visual identity, etc. And we realized this moment of where our culture was unprepared to hear what it needs to hear to do something around the climate crisis. And we know that culture is upstream from our politics, upstream from the issues that we care about. So could we do the same thing that we did for environment, but for democracy in a way that's not arrestable? So that's almost 3 years ago now that we started this endeavour that's led us to this campaign that we feel really passionate about called The Fate of Britain. About a year and a half ago, we had a first like iteration of it being in the world. That was in Manchester, where we had a four-day event that was based on democracy and climate without ever mentioning the words democracy and climate, because it was purely through the culture vehicle of people came from a really good gig and left like laughing at Jonathan Pine, realizing that they probably need to come together in community to save Britain. And it's been like this really beautiful journey, and we're starting to figure out how does this live as this large festival that exists to help Britain see itself. Because a lot of the time we don't know what British is. And I think that's kind of the issue that we're facing in politics. It's like British identity is in a way that it's so malleable, but also so stuck. I just like talking to people and getting people to recognize like, we're all in this together and there's something that all of us can do and we don't have to do it alone.
That's such a delight, a perfect way to end it, a big vision for the future and one that folds everything that's gone before into it. So thanks for giving us that.
Thank you. This has been really awesome. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Days.
That's a wrap on this series of Shaping Places from The Conduit and The Crown Estate. And I'm so thankful to all of our guests for sharing their personal stories and for you to listening to them. If you're joining us late, the full series is in your feed. And for any links or resources mentioned, check the show notes in your podcast app. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts so you'll hear when we're back. I'm Dave Erasmus with Matt Mason. We record at The Conduit in London. Until next time, take care of yourselves and look after each other.